This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
I said, what's up?
Oh, yeah.
Was satisfied.
Oh, yeah.
In life placement.
Oh, yeah.
Or dwell.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know.
Oh, yeah.
I was just a prisoner.
Oh, yeah.
Living in a cell.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But now.
Oh, yeah.
You're dwelling.
Oh, yeah.
On the first floor.
Oh, yeah.
God's love.
Oh, yeah.
Soon,
oh yeah,
we'll be waiting,
oh yeah,
to move in my room up above, yeah,
oh yeah,
in my father,
oh yeah,
house in glory,
oh yeah,
there a mantle,
oh yeah,
already prepared, yeah,
oh yeah,
built by Jesus, y'all,
oh yeah,
the only carpenter, yeah,
oh yeah,
from Galilee,
oh yeah,
oh yeah,
oh yeah,
but now,
oh yeah,
you know, what you say, girl?
Move up, stand.
We got to move, yeah.
Move up, stand.
In our room, we stand.
Move up, stand.
We got to move, yeah.
Move up, stand.
In our room, we stand.
Move up, stand.
We got to move.
Move in
my room, we stand. Oh, that is why.
That is why.
I get so happy now.
I'm so happy.
In spite of all my toils and cares.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And that was the Como Mamas, courtesy of Bob Parks, one of this week's guests. We're also joined, a surprise guest, the author, Adam Daly, and Libby Phelps, otherwise known as Liberty Phelps.
Hello.
Good afternoon to each and every one of you. And that last track told us to get ready, Bob.
Well, she's still got a bullet in her chest, apparently. They're real Mississippi blues singers. So
right.
Val Palmer gave me that, and she's, I don't know.
Well, it's a signed CD. It seems to be signed by each of the Como Mamas.
Yeah.
Esther May Wilborn, Angelia Taylor and Della Daniels.
Yeah.
Are they signed? Was it signed to you?
No,
you,
to her, and she gave it to me, so I was really pleased. Yeah. And okay. She's part of the Rhythm and Blues conceptual group,
right,
coming from Canvey Island.
OK. Are you part of this? Or
it's my group, yeah.
It's your group?
Yeah. And I've got another group, which is Parks and the Recreationals, which is a music group. This is the conceptual group behind the thing.
Yeah.
I've also got a friend.
Yes.
Adam Daly, who's here.
Exactly. You brought him along. I had no idea Adam was coming along.
No.
Adam
Neither
Daly.
Neither did I.
Say a little bit, Adam. Whatever you like.
Well, hello, everyone.
OK. And I didn't know Libby was going
to be here. First time on air, but I'm excited about this.
Libby is a surprise guest as well. Libby is an intern.
I am indeed.
And but you also present a show.
Yes, over at Hoxton Radio and Wired Radio at Goldsmiths.
Okay. Right, okay.
So Goldsmith.
Mm-hmm.
Because this guy, John Thompson, he was at Leicester, and you got a Leicester link.
I have.
He was at Leicester College of Art, and then he came down after he and Harry Thrubram were teaching there. He and Harry Thrubram were teaching there, and was head of department at Goldsmith.
Okay.
And he established the whole Rat Pack and created the milieu from which that all emerged.
There is often a kind of strange synchronicity at work on this show, isn't
there? Yeah.
There's all sorts of things happening. Adam, do you have any connection with Leicester at all?
Not at all, no.
Oh, what a shame.
I've never even been there.
What about Libby? There. Libby, have you been to Leicester? No.
Leicester cheese, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's close enough.
What about Marlborough Moby?
I believe Julian Barnes came from Leicester.
Did he?
Not my favourite author.
No, right.
Colin Wilson, you do like, who came from Leicester.
Some of Wilson's work I like, yes.
Right. So you're speaking to the mic.
Sorry.
You're a professional writer?
Well, I would hesitate to say professional because I've... Well, I suppose I call myself an outsider writer or even an outcast writer. I've been writing for over 30 years. I've written 10 books and reams of shorter material, very little of which has been published.
Okay.
And I've actually self-published all three books of the trilogy,
right,
which will be to some extent discussed today.
Yeah.
So I'd hesitate to call myself a professional.
Well, that's quite a career.
Maybe that will change.
Yeah, you know. Well, so your definition of a professional is somebody who earns a living from it?
Well, one definition, I suppose, yes. Now, I've certainly never done that.
Right.
But
if you've been doing it for 30 years...
But I sort of know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Yes, in that sense, maybe I am a professional.
Right.
But your crime was being a philosopher as well, wasn't it, really?
Possibly, yes.
So how did you meet Bob? How has this come about?
Shall I answer that? Yes, I met him about a year ago at an exhibition at the Gallery of Everything in Marylebone. And my partner and I went to the exhibition on the last day, and we didn't know he'd be there, but he was, and he gave such an extraordinary performance, I felt I had to speak to him afterwards.
Right.
Even though I did know a bit about him, because a friend of mine had mentioned the BBC documentary, which I had seen, so we went prepared to that extent.
Okay.
And I spoke to him afterwards, and we seemed to really establish a rapport.
Yeah.
And he told me about a manuscript he'd written, and the galleries emailed it to me. I've only read about half of it so far, but it's one of the most extraordinary manuscripts I have ever read.
Okay.
And since then we've met often, and he's read some of my work, and he's now planning this extraordinary project, which he'll obviously be talking more about.
But also, we've found we have a common bond with a symbolist artist, Gustave Moreau, and also, more profoundly than that, the whole of the development of art, which was absolutely nowhere, since the fin de siècle, and the Belgian and the French symbolists.
Also Nobel. Writing, of course.
Hmm. Well, both. Art
both.
And, absolutely.
Yeah.
But
I don't know so much about art, obviously.
Well, you know about Moreau.
I know about Moreau, yes, certainly.
But before the programme, we batted around this idea of outsiders and insiders. And curiously, Bob, much to my surprise, Bob said you'd call yourself an insider, Bob.
Mainstream, absolutely.
Right. Whereas I think most people would think of you as an outsider artist, and you're the other way around.
Well, I mean, partly because of my experiences. I've had such difficulties with publishers. I mean, I suppose I became rather angry, really, with the whole literary establishment.
Okay.
And as a result, I sort of became an outsider.
Right.
Not entirely from choice, but...
Are you still angry?
Not nearly so angry. I'm not so bitter, but I've learned to get on top of that. And now I'm beginning to get quite excited about my prospects.
Okay.
After 30 years, because I've only been published by very small presses. Hmm. I've never made any money, and I only have, as far as I know, a very small readership. So, and a lot of writers would just have given up in that situation. But luckily, I've been able to carry on going. So as for the mainstream, I've always had a quarrel with it. Hmm. But maybe with Bob, it will become a highly creative quarrel, and something very interesting could come out of that.
I'd like to read here. This is John Thompson, who was at Leicester College of Art with Harry Thubron in the late 60s. He then went down to Goldsmith and created the milieu from which the whole Brat Pack emerged. So he was responsible for the creation of that ethos. Now, this is in the foreword. It's just open today at Sotheby's, but it's a quote from Virginia Woolf. I'd like it to be set the tone for today's talk. Behind the cotton wool is hidden a pattern that we, I mean all human beings, are connected with this, that the whole world is a work of art, that we are parts of the work of art. Hamlet or a Beethoven quartet is the truth about this vast mass that we call the world. But there is no Shakespeare, there is no Beethoven. Certainly and empathetically, there is no God. We are the words, we are the music, we are the thing itself. And what I want to address through this project, which I'm going to get onto, which perhaps is the link between artistic actuality and actuality, and that's what we'll come on to. Over to you, Adam.
Indeed. I've only read, to be honest, some of Virginia Woolf's books. I'm not an expert on her, but I wasn't aware of that passage, but I'm very struck by it indeed.
You said something about Sotheby's. How does that figure with this?
That was, they've got his estate. John Thompson died recently.
Oh, right.
And his estate is there, so there's an auction of his...
Oh, really?
...the body, and it just opened today.
Ah, and what, the preview?
Yeah. A semblance of the works, and...
Where's that?
Sotheby's. It's on, well,
on Bond
St. George Street.
Okay. Oh, that should be interesting.
It's worth a visit, yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. So what was this manuscript, then, that you saw of Bob's?
I'll tell you the title. From Gustav Moreau to Kazimir Malevich... The Unexplored Side of Totalitarianism.
And it's, as I say, I've only read half of it so far, but Bob might obviously enlarge
on
this.
You've read some of that on air.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Yes.
Like about 10.
For him, there is obviously a link between the fin de siècle and modernism, and he also develops this very curious concept of totalitarianism, aesthetic totalitarianism,
yes,
and also romantic Stalinism. I've never come across that before.
I know. I picked him up
writers
on this last time. last time he sounded, he was almost making a case for Pol Pot.
Yes, and I remember hearing that.
And
yes.
I sort of had to sort of...
he was right to say that
Pol Pot
did study, I think, at the Sorbonne.
Yeah.
And he knew Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir.
Yeah.
So he had a background in philosophy and phenomenology.
But that's sort of like saying that Assad was an optician.
Yes, but Bob also went on to say that actually the Americans were far more at fault in that war than Pol Pot. But
okay.
I won't argue the toss over that one.
All right.
But obviously, totalitarianism has a tremendous number of very negative connotations, as does Stalinism. I mean, I suppose I read a lot of Marx's literature when I was a student, and most people on the left were staunchly anti-Stalinist, as was I. You know, I was very much a libertarian, in inverted commas, but reading Bob's manuscript has encouraged me to think that actually...
You're rethinking this.
Possibly.
Oh, another
possibly.
Stalinist.
Well,
Bob
might question this, but my interpretation of his idea is that when somebody has a really big idea, then people, in a sense, have to be maybe not forced. But
in the case of Stalin.
Well, yeah, but strongly encouraged to listen if they're ignorant. You know, they need to reach a level of understanding of the idea.
I think we should go into a Christmas
in other words,
song.
In other words, it has a collective dimension to it. You know, it's not just to do with the individual and to do with collective emancipation. Yes. And maybe, I don't know, I mean, Stalin, all right, I mean, you know, all right, some people say 100 million people died in the camps and so on.
That's a minor detail, apparently.
Absolutely.
But no, I'm slowly, I've still got half of the manuscript to read, but I'm slowly coming around to the idea. So, I'd hesitate to call myself a Stalinist yet.
But you're getting there.
Well, the aesthetic side of it interests me.
So, Bob, you have a disciple. It's like gathering momentum, this thing, isn't it?
Put a Christmas song on.
Not yet.
It's a Christmas show, everybody.
Yes, it's supposed to be. Supposed to be the run-up to Christmas. It's going to be a Stalinist Christmas.
That's the one, yeah.
Do you want one of these Christmas songs?
Yeah, anyone. Yeah, just stick it on. Let's see what happens.
Well, this is Trojan Christmas Sky.
Yeah, right, that'd be Sky.
We can always talk over it.
Yeah, talk over it, that one.
It's relaxed.
Santa Claus is going to town. Santa Claus is going to town.
Adam, you're now going to read your poem, which is perhaps you, what where,
yes,
where
I'll just explain the background to it. It's called Middlesex Axed, The Lay of a London Life. And this was something I wrote over 4 years ago after I read that the Middlesex Hospital in central London had been demolished. And that meant rather a lot to me because I was born there.
Okay.
And I almost felt that I myself was being demolished. And when I actually went down there, only one bit of the building was still intact. And I was so disturbed by it, I was, well, not so much inspired, but provoked to write this poem. And since then, of course, a huge corporate box has been put up in that space. Although when I wrote this poem, it was still a crater. Right. So, and what it is really, it develops into a critique of the whole of society, really. Okay. It's like the microcosm and the macrocosm. So that's the background.
Okay.
So I'll read, it's four pages, but I'll read some of it. Okay. I read the news with incredulity. Another hospital razed. My skull rang with the name. Middlesex, the locus of my birth, the fons of my origo. At 10 to 1 in the morning on the 7th of March, 1954, a Piscean plop from my mother's miscarrying womb. 8 pounds on the scales at the end of rations and the start of boom. Healthy if strangely different. A new life as yet uncursed by the shadow of the world, falling across the red brick of solid care, the foundry of promise on the heartline of London, or the lay of a land buried yet living, crying and rejoicing in species hope, spawning the blobs of reigning futures, carried away to grow on stimulus and repay the bill of cradle nurture, swollen now with 60 years, a socialist in the guts of human waste, clinging on to the spark flown from the fetid carcass of capital to rue the errors of an evil game, monopoly, played with human lives on the board of a company that kills all company in the lap of untreated decay and death alone with no hand of the familiar, head on a stone bed, surplus to tender spaces provided, left to fend in a fenderless world, a couldn't care less in the community world, where no self can suffice without biting the hand that feeds it as it strives to survive on its own terms, under terms that are fixed before it, in conditions that reek of the cold hand, and no charism of unconditional love, casting the die of lives led without joy and full possession of the ego's script, trapped in the otherness of the mapped out fate, mirrored in the microcosm that is London, that would squash the macrocosm of civilization into a city that once lived with the pulse of a rough paradise, a phantomagoria now dulled by the static of novelty and the cyclic regeneration of a corpse into the shiny avatar of a plastic deity, cleansing the stables of the last cleansing, and the cleansing before that, and the soul of London before that, lost in the limbos of demolished markers of a history that made sense to minds enriched by the aging of its weight, enduring long past the firefly span of shallow obsolescent totems, absent in towering incarnations of bland light, lurking only in the dusty prison cells of our memory, one tablet for each edifice gone, for no purpose other than profit, and the triumph of want over need, the service of money over the saving of life, and the health of a people, dying from the drought of gifts, in every draining sphere of inaction, the inertia of living wraiths, going through the motions of conjured motions, mad with the artifice of monotony and the severance from our true source, the umbilical cord of social bonds, retying us all after the bloody cut, the wound of time freed from the eternal, to return again in spent scraps of energy rushing after wilderness wisps, burning out the bodies of men born to lives denied them by the thieves of their time, the bosses that beggar our ambitions, driving us to the early graves, unpostponed by axed hospitals. This one I might have returned to if it were still there, when my numbered card was turned up, but it is gone, a gaping crater of slipping memory, where once a fine organ served a complement of the nation's needs, an annihilation of an acorn of selfhood that feels suddenly sucked back into its invisible beginnings, not tangible either, but confided to me once, then taken on trust in honour of a noble shrine almost sacred, a near miracle of the medical, housed in neo-Gothic splendour that would have stood centuries longer than any gimcrack Corbusier rocket carrying humanity into the skies, but not delivering them unto the gods that cannot intervene to stop a corporate block from staining the foundations of a crashed colossus wherein workers strove with virtue and science to ease and prolong our tenure on this earth, unvalued by the high-priced cynics of our robber baron economics that would lock out any Robin Hoods, yet entreat the tyro crooks of our time, granting them pride of place in temples of Mammon and Moloch, staring down on their minions who run like ants at their bidding and drop like flies in the ruins of welfare, untended, unmourned, and discarded on the dung heaps of capitalism, the prettified mounds of rotting matter, surplus to requirement statistics, fat shorn from the lean body of competitive crime against all that we essentially are, aliens in our alienation from alienated essence, mere meat in the marketplace, not men holding their reins of destiny, but saddle things in the race to extinction, the great fetish bazaar of all commodities, the reified real estate of Mr. Creosote acquisitors, the derivative fantasy deposits of immaterial wealth, the sicked-up greed gobbets of swollen speculators, the game that is not a game, that is played out in carrion grabs of pounds of flesh from the body politic that would be ours if, like Prometheus, we could unchain ourselves from the rock of obstacles. In our modern enslavement, chuck the eagles from our livers, steal back the sun and roar away the heavens, the titan tragic no more, but proud as the proles of the earth, abandoning their labour for the leisure of lords, in their own air-free right, building the celestial city of Jerusalem. Shall I stop there? I'm getting a bit exhausted, but okay. There's a lot more where that comes from.
Have a glass of water.
Thank you.
Have a drink. Perhaps we should... I don't mind, Bob. What do you think? Do you want to carry on with the poem, or do you? Are we running short of
time?
Well,
if you want to, I'm a bit worn out after that.
I don't care.
I'm happy to hear the whole poem.
Go for it, man.
I thought you were sort of getting into your...
Well, I was, but I'm getting out of breath. Are you sure?
Yeah. Have a drink.
Okay, there's quite a bit more.
That's fine. That's all right. It's okay with me.
Okay, I'll try and carry on.
It's all right with him. It's all right with me.
I might need a few breaths at some point.
That's fine.
Sorry, where was I?
Jerusalem. Yeah.
Okay, there's about another 2¾ pages to go.
That's fine.
So I'm happy with that.
Yep,
go for it.
Okay, here goes. Rosy cross hospitals in lure of prisons, with compassion and no judgment, no more Pharisee phoenixes rising from the ashes of munificence. The office block replacing the Middlesex, stopped in its developer tracks, its plan frozen by recession, the company going bust in time. Too much to hope for, yet it could transpire, sparing the crater in its decay, sprouting weeds in the crevices of capitalism, triffids of terror and sublimity, in voids of failed erections, an eloquent statement of nothing, bettering the absence of necessity, with the presence of green poppies by any other name, ivying the grave of the house that delayed the dead, honouring the still living in the veil of sickness, with a Hippocratic devotion denied to the building itself, a dying patient in bricks and mortar, overdosed with the morphine of a moratorium, its life support withdrawn as it fell still under the wrecking ball to be stretchered off under wraps to the quarry of brick bones filling the land with the unnamed scraps of desecration, one wall left as a sop to sentiment, girded for a heritaged posterity, a bit of London wall annexed to an atrium of the future to be italicised in a prospectus, unsung save in this lay of London, softening the spectral wounds of the corporate axe, wielded less by Raskolnikov or even Beeching than by Thatcher in a legacy of cuts, the imperatrix now dead at last, yet living with a venal vengeance in the funeral rites of state, austerity, the new word for butchery, redoubled in her dishonour, the rationing of healthcare, a shoo-in for the P-word, the calculus of cost, genocide by stealth, the economics of euthanasia, implemented by euphemism, geriatrics cast off like snakeskins in a trough, exploited for the biblical span, in an ageist marketplace, coated in the casuistry of capitalist contradictions, finally crossed white in serried municipal rows, dying like socialism in the feeding frenzy of murderous number-crunching sharks, the arsehole accountants and actuaries doing the maths with supernumerary demographics, killing off the old as they abuse the young, while squeezing the middle by yet one more notch of their tourniquet of mismanaged chaos in this country of frigid compassion, whilst London spawned Coram Fields once, a rare oasis of succour for orphans, never forgotten by the dwindling chanters of the old lay, to whom I venture to lay claim with this lament, intimate as the cauterization of flesh along the grid of space-time, yet opening up the labyrinths of lost love to anyone who cares to share in its cadences of anger, melancholy and pride, restoring in spirit the hospitaller's geomancy, centuries after its imprimatur, which spread from place to place, a hydra of humanity at its best, not the unslayable beast of mythic yore, but the ground plan of a life form, taking care of itself, like Wittgenstein's logic and all our ethics in a post-Marxist, post-Nietzschean world where values transvalues also return to source in the hearts and minds of men, if not in the provisions of those pygmies presuming to preside over us all, courtesy of votes no mindful citizens would ever cast, save for themselves, not the political class, the power-puffing, ego-stuffing poseurs, dropping the mess of mankind on the masses' heads, these cushioned elites propped up on their stilts of subordination that we blindly uphold and never bring down with a single step out of line, a demolition to be desired, the superstructure crashing with a cosmic echo, the big bang that will end capitalism, not open the gates to its jackals, detonating the ministries of misrule, not traducing the bedrocks of our comfort and consolation, leaving fewer beds for us all and no nursing through the coders of our decline, as we wait for death on lengthened lists in the loneliness of unheated homes or the desolation of trolleys left in corridors by staff who cannot cope with their crushing burdens, growing callous as prison warders, clinging to their tenures on the slow tide of collapse, treating too many with too little in a black hole wreckage ring-fenced by taxpayers' hides, government as clueless as it is powerless, corporations leeching our lifeblood through the flight of capital unfetched from far-off havens, spared in return for patronage, swelling the coffers of cadres, no trickle-down into our empty pockets or the sooted, outstretched hands of beggars, just wasted or forgone, as all support fails and we drift into comatose anarchy, wanting to rebel but with no means to oppose, move to rage but our sound does not travel far or even come out at all, trapped, lifeless in a system that impels us on but strips us raw as it does so, unstoppable, unchangeable, irredeemable, an inferno that rarely burns or freezes but stays enervatingly the same. Its suffering of the dispiriting sort, bequeathing wrinkles with each suffocation of hope, sagging and sinking towards prostrate prayer in the beds that are no longer there, in a space that is thin air, but for the stain of souls coming and going, come and gone, in a cube of crystal past, evanescent in present time, suppurating in its shifts of space and the lapse of its name, genderless angel of grace, epicenter in the ether of London, murdered sojourn of the sick, that will not be avenged, but effaced and forgotten by all, except the singers of this song, my song, if the song of others, my being erased in retrospect, no mere metaphoric extinction, but a trace theft that carries me with it whole into a void that is not commemorated, just noted by me as I walk the perimeter of my birthplace, staring into my own absence, trying the time travel thought experiment and failing to reconnect with my lost self, encircling the limbo of middle distance, musing sadly with figments upon fragments, fleetingly palpable and lastingly phantasmic, angry at the severance of sight and self, powerless to restore, yet blessing with mind, agonizing over the double umbilical cut, mired in the mysteries of the city at this spot, and elsewhere an echo of the retrievals of spirit, filtered via the stillness of urban eddies and the rough cacophony of traffic in the time-fractured spaces of my haunts, forever revisited in my dull trances and sudden epiphanies of fresh slanted visions that do seem to make this life worthwhile for a moment that I might extend or not after my first death, the death of my birth, during this lull of perplexity in the second life leading to my last death or undeath in the crushed morgue beneath my feet, the twinning of life and death in rebirth, no ashes spilled, just a lair in the labyrinth in which to wander alone and unknown between the thresholds of being and non-being, flown from the land into the pit from which some other monstrous baby might be sprung, a curse of greater nihilism, holding the axemen to account in the hidden scales of justice, a changeling come to conquer by the stealth of a resurrection, with a difference, a witness to what can't be saved, whispering the new Babylon's fall on the wind that rocks all walls to their foundations in no faith, the writing on the wall before me that will stand the test of time in invisible ink, tree bushes sprouting from the cracks in derelict defiance of the sleek pane ziggurat built at its side like Lang's metropolis set, only bereft of its brilliance, the futurity of the fantastic betrayed by the ubiquity of the grand porter cabin, obsolete and hazardous in 30 years, boosting construction to kickstart the cycle, whilst the Victorians always built to last, the Gothic living on like Dracula in the castle of an English home, ever reinvented if long mocked, enduringly our myth if also Europe's, as good a vernacular as any in which to embody our homage to whatever is best in us, an essence we can show in outward form that clothes and reveals our inner core. Yet travesty is on the march, gathering pace for a century or so now, destroying the good old to build the bad new. Change is not always progress, but it accelerates like a child flicking from sight to sight, our judgment slipping as the attention span shrinks. We cannot stay still for as long as before, yet we must renew more and more for its own sake, losing sight, touch, memory of what endures, sustains, enriches, and losing ourselves fast in a blur of surface thrills and endless facelifts of a face we no longer recognise or which is no longer there, in palimpsests of grease paint, waves of facile frippery, blown and bursting bubbles of simulated bliss, reconfigurations of nothing, evaporations of ennui, the designer detritus of a great growth machine going nowhere, even as it overtakes us, carrying us on in its all-consuming wake, then cutting us adrift in its miasma. If small was once beautiful, big is now the only game in town. Gone global, viral, swallowing the individual, a mere speck in the blind eye of the totality. The 7 billion aggregate of recreational procreation, but still the precious, fundamental, irreducible unit of the society that does exist over and above the state and the cormorant marketplace and all the bodies that would suck it dry of the organic blood of spontaneous gathering and the cementing of togetherness, the phantom of utopia seeding the black clouds of despair with white light glimpses of an inimitable realm, drawing us like a magnet from afar, bathing the world in vision, restoring the ether to the earth, the home of our birth, the platter of our life, the gravitational pull of our death, our solace in the skies, seas and valleys, and the comforting fonts of our deliverance, the shared sights of our entrances and exits, that we strive in life to stay out of, but praise when we end our days, as we must, sinking to the Procrustean floor of our fates, the manger in reverse, not finding a crater or a shelterless street or a cell of loneliness, but a radiant sinecure of warm passage in the ward that punctuates our brief release from eternity into the river of time that dries in the grave when our saviours can no longer keep its trickle and stretch the span from source to outflow via stations of the beating heart, the vital pulse, the sanctum of breath, the body immortal in the repair rooms of supernature, still softly visible to the clairlucent eye in the airless ground and groundless air of the Middlesex axed, an emblem of all endeavour, lost forever in the tangible threads as the elixir quest goes on still, in the as yet unaxed laboratories of human healing, and in the minds of the impossiblest researchers everywhere, perfecting the crucible and conduit of our journey and transmigration, the entelechies of all egos, in the discoveries of the divine, wherefore medical science and love become one, and the agents of our dissolution are banished one by one, our histories, selves and trajectories of becoming, recovered in the cathedrals of care, the great enablers of everything that we cannot be without, on the asymmetric tip of time's arrow, which, if reversed, may capture space traversed in matter as in mind, an Augean cleansing of materialist clutter and minding matter, preserving what matters in our minds, my own hovering deracinated, above and around and beneath the spot of my apparition, twice dislocated from the palpable, reunited more in imagining than in remembering, a fractured elusive truth, illumined by circuitous strivings in the poetics of place, the phenomenon knocking on the noumenon door, the wrenched spirit returning to a bare patch of rest, saturated with sorrow, yet clinging to a residue of hope that time will merge again with the eternal, and a great new edifice will arise in a shimmering aura, ancient and contemporary, serving its purpose beyond expedient, and where I too may come back, no vertical wanderer, but a horizontal ghost.
Jimmy Smith.
That's all right. Well, you could talk about the poem if you want. I mean, you were talking about the poem. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and that poem was by Adam Daly, today's surprise guest, brought along by Bob Parks, one of my regular contributors, and the whole thing is witnessed by Libby Phelps.
Reflecting on G.S. Fraser, who's my tutor at Leicester. His favourite poem was Tintern Abbey by Wordsworth, which is basically the sylvan why and the recollection of memories philosophically in rest. Mm. We don't have that opportunity anymore to come out of. Something like Malevich's Black Square wasn't about the end of art, but it was about stop, just stop, like we should do now with computers, just stop. what they do to us, just stop. Just even if it's for a split second, but stop this. And I think it was the impetus of your poem, was a sort of tirade against this idea of progress and this idea of capitalist advancement.
Yes,
that's basically leading to hell.
Well, yes.
pessimistic.
Hopefully, that's all the end. And I mean, if I have
especially a Christmas show, Bob.
A question about Malevich. Malevich didn't represent the end of art then.
No,
but
not at all.
A new beginning.
Yeah,
and you have a particular idea of that, which I find very powerful.
And let's talk about the Russian cosmos. But really,
yes.
I want while you're here,
yes.
And while I'm here, and while William's here. The point was that a couple of times ago when I was here, we were talking about this project, and of which I've taken your title, The Reigns of the Transfinite.
Yes.
That's the third part of your
trilogy
where No Name Now, this archetypal character who is the anti-hero. Well, he's not, the archetype.
Yes.
The anti-archetype.
Yes, I think of him as a figure rather than a character. I don't really do character.
No.
I find that a rather bourgeois obsession of writers.
The figure is bigger than God.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
He transcends
absolutely,
God.
Absolutely.
Or transcends godness.
Well, he's a Nietzschean sort of overman figure, I suppose.
Did you hear...
And Lautréamont's Maldoror is
did
is
you hear... Melvin Bragg on Thursday when he talked about hope.
A bit of it, yes. I did actually, yes, some Nietzsche, of it. Nietzsche was discussed. That's
Nietzsche,
right,
and
yes.
Also the Greeks who thought that hope was evil and labelled it against, which is rather controversially, the opposite of what, because it came out of Pandora's box,
exactly,
as all the evils, and yes, it was a bit, yes, left, was left behind. So
yes,
it's
that's right.
An ambiguous quality that, yes, that's underpinned. Which, anyhow, so as but, you say, this kind of.
But were you saying about this forum? Is this relate to this forum you're involved
in? Yes, exactly.
With?
Now, the character, No Name Now, which in this volume, which is the last one, The Reigns of the Transphite, he moves into the multiverse and disappears. In the first one, The Outcast's Burden, he's born of a witch.
Oh, can I correct you?
Yes, go on.
Actually, I don't make it clear what he is born of at all.
He's
found by a madwoman as an abandoned infant on the Hackney Marshes of all places. And I suppose I was thinking of Ian Sinclair, a writer I hugely admire. So I didn't at the time. I wrote this about 20 years ago, know very much about East London, but I'd already read some of his work. So I wanted to start the book there, even though it wasn't my territory, because I grew up in Hampstead and I live in West London.
Right.
But when I started writing, reading Sinclair's work in the 1990s, I became much more fascinated by East London. So the book starts there.
Right.
And the woman is more of a mad woman than a witch. But then when he grows, and he is, of course, an incarnation of, in a sense, evil, but more than evil, because this figure, as Bob said, is greater than God and the devil. And then he consumes the woman. And then cannibalism becomes the motif. Quite why that was the case, I don't quite know. It came to me unconsciously.
Why does he have to eat a woman?
Well, exactly. Well, it could have been a man. Eventually it's everyone. Some of the people listening will be familiar with this book, not everyone. And it doesn't end well for humanity.
Which book?
Because they nearly, The Outcast Burden,
oh, I see.
The first part of the trilogy.
Yes. Okay.
And of course, I wasn't thinking of it as a trilogy at that time. Hmm. In fact, I wrote this in 1999, and it was really an apocalyptic end of millennium work. And, much of humanity does get eaten. And of course, there's a symbolism in the idea of cannibalism, that this does, in a sense, represent human relationships under global state capitalism.
Right.
That was the idea behind it. But then, of course, it becomes completely insane.
Well, if you think of that in relation to symbolism and fantasy thinking, what led up to it was Impressionism, which was the release of colour.
Yes.
So colour determined what we saw from that point onwards.
Yes.
So it was no longer an object or this or that. It was colour that was perceived in nature.
And does that include the colour of blood? There's a lot of blood.
That would be a label. Yeah. It was the colour of what is there.
Yes.
And then from that, the symbolist freed up thought.
Yes.
So firstly, anything becomes available on the visual plane through the Impressionists. Then anything becomes available internally through what the symbolist stood for. And then we have Cézanne, who brought the two together.
Who you think was the greatest artist who ever lived.
Because he was the first artist to work directly to direct consciousness, or to address consciousness, bypassing the five senses. So his reflection on, i.e., just imagine Einstein's plane, and you've got an atom that doesn't exist there, the whole picture plane would break down.
Yes.
So Cézanne said, I have to paint everything equally. And that, so he's beginning to work this idea of actuality.
Yes.
And this is where I'm coming on to. So as a performance artist, that move as a painter was the paintbrush in the fingertips. Well, I won't say what it was for Renoir, but you can assume what it might have been, in the fingertips.
Yes.
The external mark. Performance art, which then is a hybrid in a sense, is the fingertip to the brain, so it embodies the body. So where that resides. See you in a moment. I've forgotten what I'm talking about.
Well, you have a fascinating concept of the mark, don't you? Which is not just any squiggle.
I was just beginning to get somewhere interested.
It's okay. Tell me more about this forum, because you both...
Paul Clay's Walking a Line. That's an interesting concept of the mark, isn't it? What do you think of that? Or do you know about that?
Paul Clay did.
That would be an example.
If I could just... this forum that you're both involved with... This is a fairly new phenomenon. It's an ongoing thing. You've just joined us, I think.
I didn't want to get involved initially.
Was it something to do with this?
Oh, yes.
What's that?
Muriel Belcher.
Yeah. But it, didn't you model something on the Colony Room?
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yes, yep.
Well, we're meeting in the Colony Room. Ken Ford, who will, yeah, I've got, yeah. There's two dimensions to it. One is a show for which we've got possible funding from an art person in Brussels. I'm working with an artist, a symbolist artist in Brussels, and Ken Ford, who was my tutor in my work, who knew close friends with Francis Bacon at his... Yeah. A Soho period. Also, Sophie Parkin, who's I've forgotten his name, the scat singer, Vutarina, is the guy who had Cement Mixer. Slim Galliard.
Oh, Slim.
Yeah. We convened the symposium on the forum in a room at this, which is a continuation of the Colony Club. So we're continuing that ethos. Now, backing that up is a person that we went to a talk at Westminster Reference Library on the Bohemian London. Oh, yes. And at that, this director, Uruguayan director...
Pablo Berens, who may be listening.
Hi, Pablo. Hi, okay, who directed a film, Colin Wilson.
Adrift in Soho. Yeah.
And Colin Wilson attended the Gateway School, and also Ken Ford attended the Gateway School. And then a close friend of mine, John, attended the Gateway School. And our host here is a Leicester person. So there's very much an identification with Leicester. Mm. So out of that, this idea to address everything as a platform,
yes,
without preconceived ideas. Yes. On the one hand, this show, and there's a gallery, Elephant West, and it's a psychogeographic connection with a friend I've got, Helen Tyler, right, who has the only thatch roof cottage in London and an acre in her garden, who's identified a shamanistic area in her garden. And I'm interested... because my project now is to recreate this No Name Now character, the challenge. Now, my credentials are having
this
gone
is
through...
dangerous territory, but
well, having
but
gone
it doesn't
through,
have to be dangerous, but it could be.
Well, first of all, you said he's not a character.
Well, what I mean is I think of him as an archetypal figure.
Right.
And if you think of Descartes' evil genius... let's just say Nietzsche's Superman for simplicity's sake.
So Bob is going to try and summon up this
yes, he does terrible things, you know, but he's not
like
just
news,
evil. He's not just evil. No. He's more complex than that.
Okay.
And in the final work, there's a dialectical synthesis in a way, right, going beyond good and evil in Nietzsche's sense. That's the idea of it. But I have to let a lot of light in as well as darkness.
To what extent is this fiction and how much is it?
Mainly fiction, but I have to say, and this might astonish some people, nearly all of the characters or figures are based on people I knew.
Right.
A lot of them are dead now, but although I magnify them and mutate and metamorphose them in the book into what I call meta-human monsters, the essential characteristics of people I knew. And I don't think I could have invented them, actually. You couldn't make them up.
And, so the people you knew were monsters, or...?
Not literally monsters, but I better explain. After I completed my education, I left home in my 20s. Instead of pursuing a career, I went the other way. I dropped out monumentally. Mm. I became a sort of bohemian bum, to be honest. I came from quite a privileged background. I grew up in a period house in Hampstead. I went to public school. I got 2 degrees. My parents wanted me to be a civil servant. The last thing I wanted to be, I would sooner work down a sewer than be a civil servant. And I was very troubled, to be honest. And I felt I was living in a bourgeois prison. I had to get out because I'd had quite a conventional middle-class upbringing. I needed to experience a completely different experience of life. And to my amazement, it was right on my doorstep because I lived in Hampstead. And a lot of people think Hampstead is the preserve of the rich. Well, in the 1970s, there was a huge squatting community there and quite a lot of rough sleepers on Hampstead Heath, and I saw these people all around. And I was fascinated by them as I was growing up, and I just went up to somebody in the street and introduced myself to him, who looked like a tramp, and he was one of the most amazing people I've ever met, rather like Iron Foot Jack.
And then the move in The Outcast's Burden, he comes from East London into Central London and sort of goes through Middlesex...
Yes.
On the way out. Now, I come from Southall, which is in West London also.
Yes.
And so where there was, in the 60s, a strong rhythm and blues identity, a lot of the Ealing Club, Alexis Corner. And that was why I bring in the rhythm and blues identity. So that's my dimension, yes, that's my contribution.
Absolutely.
And then they take off as minotaurs.
But if I can just complete the story. Yes, so this extraordinary character, who actually, he was quite well known. He knew, do you remember Peter Cook?
Yes.
Do you know George Weiss?
No.
He was Captain Rainbow.
Okay.
Very eccentric character. He used to contest by-elections, a bit like Screaming Lord
Sutch.
Oh,
yes, okay.
And he knew this character very well. He was known locally as Bronco, and because he used to dress in cowboy clothing. Mm. Wonderful, eccentric character.
Right.
Nobody really knew anything about him. I never knew his name. I only learnt it after his death. Right. He was called John Cork. And nobody really knew anything about his past. Mm. He was like a harlequin. He had a tragic life, because he lived rough a lot of the time. But people were fascinated by him. There were a lot of writers and academics in Hampstead who got to know him, and they regarded him as the ultimate existentialist anti-hero. But he was the conduit to that world, because he introduced me to all these extraordinary outcasts, and it revolutionised my life.
Right.
And I didn't know at that time that I wanted to be a writer. And it took me 10 years. I was a late starter. I didn't start in earnest, apart from writing odd poems and short stories and essays, till I was 32. But all the while, I was absorbing all of this experience, observing and studying these people, having extraordinary conversations, you know. And I felt I was right outside civilization, because some of these people were... Well, they were the sort of people that any normal person would cross the road to avoid.
They'd run across
the road. But I was fascinated by them.
Right.
The more grotesque they were, the more I sought them out.
So are these the people
and
that...
they provided me with the basis for my characters or figures.
So,
I honestly don't think... I couldn't have made these characters up.
Right. So the forum consists of a sort of extension of these people, and I'm sure you won't...
In a sense,
you
yes.
won't,
a lot of whom are dead, now.
The thesis behind it is... Because my art education was to work to not have preconceived ideas and essentially adopt a non-artistic approach to art. So there's the visual part of it, which I've already discussed, which is the Belgian artist and Ken Ford's work, which is sort of pantheistic view of nature.
Michel Tombroff.
Yes.
Michel
Tombroff. And then the other part is the creation of this character, which I see as a group effort. So I've got Mr. Chalk, who's got owns the only handmade men's shoe shop in London, and a whole variety of characters. He couldn't make it today, but he was trying to make it.
Yes.
And out of that, I want to make it a composite of everyone's point of view, not just mine, but
I think it has to be, actually. It's so vast.
And Chalk could make a garment that would characterise this character. And so I haven't got a preconception. We've also got Charlemagne Palestine.
After
you've written this two-page, three-page introduction, what is the title of the...
I'm working on something at the moment, which I've called Dark... I've only just started it. Dark Invocation, which will serve as an overture to the performance.
And then
it will only be a few pages long, but it will be very dense, dark and apocalyptic.
So I can
I'll hand the baton to Bob.
That's right, I can pass it over to Charlemagne Palestine for inspiration.
It's sort of like a occult Stalinist.
There is an occult... there is an occult element.
Now we're getting there.
Perhaps you ought to get onto that.
Now it's getting vaguely interesting.
Because there will be some occultists involved in this, won't there, Bob?
Sal's a witch.
Witches, shamans,
she's
magicians... And I'm not an occultist in the practicing sense, but I know a lot about the occult.
Can we squeeze in one more Christmas song before it ends?
That's going to be the end of the show. Then.
I know, it's all right.
I've really enjoyed this.
Oh, good. Right. Well, you'll have to come back and
like
carry on.
Desert Island.
I was terrified before I saw it.
It's like Desert Island.
Well, we're terrified now. Of what is to come.
Pick one of those tunes, and that'll be the last one.
Christmas.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with Bob Parks, Adam Daly and Libby Phelps.
Happy Christmas.
Thank you all very much for coming on, and perhaps Adam and Bob might come back and continue this
philosophical discussion. I'll quite enjoy it.
Great. All right. Which one shall we have, Bob? We've got Christmas Love. Maybe that one.
Here, go on.
Shall we go for that?
Yeah, go for it.
Yes.
Okay.
Why not?
Rather than twist.
Falling softly to the ground.
Everyone is happy. There's joy all around.
Children are happy, 'cause Christmas time is here.
Everyone is eager to help and do his share.
trees on Christmas.
Is love,
sweet love, love is necessary.
Choirs are singing songs of goodwill.
Though it's cold outside, no one feels the chill.
Violence is still.
At the center of love.
Mm-hmm. Don't forget Chicago.
Oh, the streets of Chicago need love.
You know, all the world needs on Christmas is a little love.
Oh, yeah.
Sweet love. Choirs are singing.
Thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.